Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is December the 18th, 2019. Santa has begun packing up his sleigh. He is rounding up 8 reindeers to make an historic trip. A shout out to all the military men and women serving our country and is away from home at this time of the year. We thank you for your services. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Tonight we have the following news. ICANN's total lack of transparency, and it's way too easy to get a .gov domain name. Our feature segments this evening. Mark Leoso on the mark with a Seagate OneTouch solid-state drive review. Benjamin Rockwell in his IT Pro series will talk about employee inclusion in employer software agreements. And from the Tech Corner, how to protect yourself and your money this holiday season, and the countdown is on till January the 14th for the end of Windows 7 support. And Marty Winston, all hands on tech, the changing face of CES, the Consumer Electronics Show. ICANN's total lack of transparency. Who is ICANN? The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. ICANN is a nonprofit organization that oversees the assignment of both IP addresses and domain names. ICANN had managed the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, that's the IANA, under contract to the United States Department of Commerce, that's the DOC. ICANN was incorporated in California on September the 30th, 1998, with entrepreneur and philanthropist Esther Dyson as the founding chairwoman. On August the 1st of 2016, the United States handed oversight and control of the NETS address book to a nonprofit. The transfer involved the Internet Domain Name System, or DNS, which translate the web addresses you type into your browser. The United States Department of Commerce shuttled control of the DNS to a nonprofit called the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, that's ICANN, I-C-A-N-N, whose multiple stakeholders include technical experts as well as representatives of governments and businesses. Critics had argued the transfer could lead to authoritarian countries taking control of the Internet and eventually censoring content throughout the world. But ICANN said such fears were uninformed. The group said that ICANN is a technical organization and does not have the remit or ability to regulate content on the Internet. They say that this is true under the contract with the U.S. government and would continue to remain true even without the contract with the U.S. government. Last month, ICANN sold the registry contract for .org to Ethos Capital, who is a profit-making organization. It also removed the price cap on domain registration. What we have here is ICANN, a nonprofit organization, selling the registration administration of nonprofit .org organizations to Ethos Capital, a profit-making organization. They also removed the price increase cap. What is the business model of Ethos Capital? It is a profit-making corporation, and its only business is the administration of the .org domain. Well, who is Ethos Capital? Ethos Capital is a new private equity firm founded by Eric Brooks. He left Abry Partners this year after spending 2 decades at the investment firm. The investment firm acquired the domain name ethoscapital.com at the end of October of this year. The company that Eric Brooks left, Avery Partners, acquired Donuts and installed former ICANN president of global domains, Akram Atala, in the top spot there. Donuts Inc. owns top-level internet domains, for example, in the domain name www.example.com, the top-level name is .com. Donuts co-founder John Nevitt left to be CEO of Public Interest Registry. Public Interest Registry is a not-for-profit created by the Internet Society, that's ISOC, back in 2002. To manage the top.org top-level domains. It took over the operation of .org in January 2003. The other person at Ethos is former ICANN Senior Vice President Abosita Ori. Ethos Capital founder and CEO Eric Brooks has no experience within that industry. The firm's website lists only Brooks and one Nora Abosita Ori, who joined the outfit last month as its chief purpose officer, as employees. But there's a common thread between those two, and it is Fadi Shahadi, a former CEO of ICANN, the organization that oversees the domain name system and awards the contracts to run internet registries. It was under Shahadi that ICANN radically changed its approach to internet registries, including a massive expansion of the internet namespace and a move towards a free market approach to internet addresses. On May 7th of this year, Fadi Shahadi registered ethoscapital.org. He is listed as the owner in WhoIs, and that was just before a Delaware company by the name of Ethos Capital was formed. That date is significant because it is one day after ICANN indicated it was planning to approve the lifting of price caps through its public comment summary. In case you wonder about the thread that ties Brooks, Abosita Ori, and the CEO of Public Interest Registry, well, does the name Avery ring a bell? That's because it's the company that bought new top-level domain name Donuts last year. That deal involved Avery's senior advisor, Fadi Shahadi, and Shahadi is the former CEO of ICANN, the group that oversees the domain name industry. Now we have a 20-year veteran of Avery who worked on the Donuts deal and was, or still is, a member of the Donuts board, leaving this year to form a new entity that buys a registry, much like how Avery bought Donuts. And the CEO of Public Interest Registry is John Nevitt, one of the founders of Donuts. The other person listed on Ethos Capital's website is Nora Abosita Ori. She worked for Shahadi at ICANN as SVP, Development and Public Responsibility Programs. In other words, I realize that this is all very complex and confusing. The folks all mentioned here are involved, are very closely connected, and it happens right after ICANN, going against the public's clearly stated interests, suddenly made the .org domain space much more open to profit exploitation. The whole thing is incredibly sketchy. And while Ethos Capital has put out a meaningless statement promising to keep the .org domain space accessible and reasonably priced for all, and to live within the spirit of historic practice when it comes to pricing, though admitting it might start adding in annual price increases of up to 10% on average. Assuming everything is above board, the entire sequence of events does not pass the smell test of conflict and interest. No one involved has done anything to address the concerns of how this all went down. The Internet Society insists that Ethos Capital only approached it about buying Public Interest Registry a couple months ago, but given the dates and activities described above, it's reasonable to infer that Ethos was planning this out from the time that ICANN decided it was going to drop the price cap on the .org domains. The one new fact is what everyone already suspected, that Shahadi is associated with Ethos Capital as an advisor. though it downplays that role and tries to talk up how he advises lots of companies. Thing is, mere advisors aren't usually the people registering domain names. Separately, it's now been revealed who is financing this whole thing. And I guess this is now much more simpler to understand. The bulk of the money would come from the investment vehicles of renowned U.S. Republican billionaires, Perot Holdings, tied to former presidential candidate Ross Perot, closely associated with the Johnson family, who's one of the Republicans' biggest backers, and Solomir Capital, tied to Republican Senator Mitt Romney. It is reported in the Register that Vint Cerf is supporting this move and even insisting that if Ethos raised the prices of .org domains to $60 a year, that's not such a big deal. Who is Vint Cerf? Vinton Gray Cerf, a.k.a. Vint Cerf, is an American internet pioneer and is recognized as one of the fathers of the internet, sharing this title with TCP/IP co-developer Bob Kahn. This is extremely disappointing. Going back to how it all got started in October of 2016, President Barack Obama said it made sense to transfer control of ICANN to an international community. He noted that this community is made up of technical experts who help build the internet. It was claimed the transfer would help ensure freedom of expression, because giving our control to ICANN would keep the internet out of the hands of the UN and its International Telecommunications Union, where Russia and China have been grasping for it. In 2020 hindsight, control of ICANN should never have occurred. Pardon my French, this whole thing stinks. It's way too easy to get a .gov domain name. Many believe they can trust links and emails coming from U.S. federal government domain names, or else assume that there are at least more stringent verification requirements involved in obtaining a .gov domain name versus a commercial one ending in .com or .org. But a recent experience suggests this trust may be severely misplaced, and that it is relatively straightforward for anyone to obtain their very own .gov domain. Krebs on Security received an email from a researcher who said he got a .gov domain simply by filling out and emailing an online form, grabbing some letterhead off the homepage of a small U.S. town that only has a .us domain name, and impersonating the town's mayor in the application. He used a fake Google voice number and fake Gmail address. He asked to remain anonymous, but who said he did it mainly as an experiment. The only thing that was real was the mayor's name. The email from this source was sent from an Exeter.Rhode Island or Exeter.RI.US, a domain registered on November the 14th, at that time displayed the same content as the .us domain that it was impersonating, which belonged to the town of Exeter, Rhode Island. He had to fill out an official authorization form, which basically just lists the admin, tech guy, and billing guy. Also, it needs to be printed on official letterhead, which of course everyone knows is easily forged just by Googling a document of the said municipality, and then you can either mail or fax it in after you sent an account creation link to all the contacts. Technically, what he did was wire fraud. Had he done it through the U.S. mail, he could be facing mail fraud charges if caught. But a cyber criminal, particularly a state sponsor actor operating outside the United States, likely would not hesitate to do so if he thought registering as a .gov was worth the effort to make his malicious website, emails, or fake news social media campaign more believable. Krebs on Security contacted officials in the real town of Exeter, Rhode Island, to find out if anyone from the U.S. General Services Administration, the federal agency responsible for managing the .gov domain registration process, had sought to validate the request prior to granting a .gov in their name. A person who called back from the town clerk office, but who asked not to be named, said someone from the GSA did phone the mayor's office on November 24th, which was 4 days after he reached out to the federal agency about the domain in question, and approximately 10 days after the GSA had already granted the phony request. A GSA spokesperson said the agency doesn't comment on any open investigations. GSA is working with the appropriate authorities and has already implemented additional fraud prevention controls without elaborating on what those additional controls might be. Krebs on Security did get a substantive response from the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which, by the way, happens to be a division of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, which is leading efforts to protect the federal.gov domain of civilian government networks. The CISA said this matter is so critical to maintaining the security integrity of the .gov space that DHS now is making a play to assume control over the issuance of all .gov domains. The .gov top-level domain is critical infrastructure for thousands of federal, state, and local governments organizations across the country. It is used by these institutions should instill trust in order to increase the security of all U.S.-based government organizations. CISA is seeking the authority to manage the .gov and assume governance from the General Service Administration. The transfer would allow CISA to modernize the .gov registrar, enhance the security of individual .gov domains, ensure that only authorized users obtain a .gov domain, proactively validate existing .gov holders, and better secure that everyone that relies on the .gov is legitimate. GSA has been an important partner in these efforts, and the two agencies will continue to work hand in hand to identify and implement near-term security enhancements to the .gov. In an era when the nation's top intelligence agencies continue to warn about ongoing efforts by Russia and other countries to interfere in our elections and democratic processes, it may be difficult to understand that an attacker could so easily leverage such a simple method for impersonating state and local authorities. Despite the ease with which apparently anyone can get their own .gov domain, there are plenty of major U.S. cities that currently do not have one, probably because they never realized they could with very little effort or expense. And a review of the top 10 most populous U.S. cities indicates only half of them have obtained .gov domains, which includes Chicago, Dallas, Phoenix, San Antonio, and San Diego. Houston.gov, Los Angeles.gov, New York City.gov, and Philadelphia.gov are all still available. By the way, don't rush out to get it. As is the .gov for San Jose, California, the economic, cultural, political center of Silicon Valley. No doubt a great number of smaller cities also haven't figured out they're eligible to obtain their own .gov domains. Having said all this, some of these cities do have .gov domains in a different manner, such as in the case of New York City, nyc.gov. But it's not clear whether the GSA would allow the same city to have multiple .gov domains. In addition to being able to convincingly spoof communications from and websites for cities and towns, there are almost certainly a myriad of other ways that possessing a phony .gov domain could be abused. In another case, a source said he was able to register his domain in Facebook's law enforcement subpoena system, although he says he did not attempt to abuse that access. The source who successfully registered as an imposter .gov domain said he was able to use that access to register for Facebook's law enforcement subpoena system. Back in the day, everyone not in the federal government was supposed to register in the .us space. At some point, someone decided .gov is going to be more democratic and let everyone in states register. But as we can see, there is no validation. The internet itself is yet another example of an important resource with potentially explosive geopolitical implications that was never designed with security authentication in mind. GSA is pretty good at doing boring clerical stuff, but we keep discovering what we once thought was a boring clerical thing now actually has real-world security implications. By the way, all this about the .gov, well, at least the GSA is getting involved in it. But just remember, there's no one, in terms of governance, making sure that the .orgs are legitimate and real. Mark Leoso on the mark with a Seagate OneTouch solid-state drive review.
I'm Mark Leosa with On The Mark. Last week, On The Mark reviewed the My Passport 2TB hard disk drive. This week, we're reviewing the Seagate OneTouch solid-state drive, available in 500GB and 1TB storage. There's a special edition Cameo design for the OneTouch 500GB drive, available in red, blue, green, and gray camo. All come with a small loop with an embossed Seagate logo and a 3-year limited warranty. The OneTouch is solid state. That means there are no moving parts and faster than a hard disk drive and silent. They're compact, a little bigger than a business card, just under 3 inches long, a bit more than 2 inches wide, and almost 4/10 of an inch thick, and weighs a little more than 2¼ ounces. There's a fabric covering on the wide sides of the drives, available in black or white. One enticement for photographers and videographers is a 1-year subscription to MyLeo Create, a photo organizing program that will sort images chronologically or by subject and share them securely with your social networks. Another draw is a 2-month Adobe Creative Cloud photography plan that has over 20 desktop and mobile apps to customize your images. On top of that, your data is protected with the Advanced Encryption Standard 256-bit key. The OneTouch came out of the box with a USB 3, now called USB 3.2 Gen 1, and hooked it up to an Asus computer with a USB 3.0 port. After completing a short registration and a download of the Toolkit software and Sync Plus, we were ready to go. The OneTouch has continuous auto backup, something you and Hank Key will appreciate. If you don't have a USB 3 port, there are adapters, but they may not be compatible with older computers that have PC card connectors. For computers that have Express card connectors, you might be in luck. Desktop users will need an extra slot for a PCI Express card. Check your computer specs for compatibility. The OneTouch will transfer data with a USB 2.0, but at a much slower rate than a USB 3.0 port. A small white LED indicates the OneTouch's activity. Using a Microsoft Surface Pro with a USB 2.0, transfer 25 gigs to the OneTouch. It took 3 minutes and 48 seconds. Transferring 25 gigs from an Asus computer with the USB 3.0 to OneTouch took 1:49, more than twice as fast. The OneTouch has the advantage of compact size, weight, and speed if you're using a USB 3.0 port or adapter. Price-wise, external SSD drives are 3 to 4 times more expensive than the same storage capacity as an external hard disk drive. It's the holiday season. Shop around. Bundled with a free 1-year MyLeo Create subscription and a free 2-month Adobe Creative Cloud photography plan will help visual artists realize their visions, making the OneTouch on the mark. I'm Mark Leosa.
Thank you, Mark. How to protect yourself and your money this holiday season. As holiday shopping goes up, so does the possibility for fraud. There are a few tips to consider to protect your purchases as well as your bank account from the fraudsters. Don't let your card out of sight. Unscrupulous restaurant staff and shop clerks have been known to collect credit card information with a skimming device simply by snapping a picture. Monitor your accounts closely. Fraudsters often sit on your bank or credit card details for weeks and months, hoping to catch you unaware when you're back in a familiar routine. If possible, set up mobile banking alerts for your smartphone so you can spot unusual activity right away. Ally Bank customers can set alerts for debit transactions that go over a set amount. Be wary of internet cafes and public Wi-Fi. No internet connection or Wi-Fi signal is totally secure, but there are ways to determine whether a particular network is relatively safe to use. It's surprisingly easy for a hacker to monitor your browsing on a public network, even if there's a password or encryption certificate. If possible, use your debit card for cash access only and avoid suspicious ATMs if anything on the front of the ATM looks broken, dislodged, or jerry-rigged. It could mean that someone has installed a card skimming device. Many banks now offer some form of credit, debit, card management so that if your bank offers a card control feature, understand how to use it. For example, if your card is lost or misplaced, turn it off immediately to protect yourself. To further protect customers from this type of activity, the Ally Card Control app designed to allow customers to personalize how, when, and where their card can be used to give them additional control and protection for their debit cards. A really cool setting for travelers is a feature that allows cardholders to keep their debit card active around their phone or only within a specified region on a map. It's also a good idea to have a backup plan like another card or some other cash on hand so you're not stranded with no way to pay or access funds. It's a time for Christmas, but you don't want to have the fraudsters have the upper hand on you. Benjamin Rockwell, in his IT Pro series, we'll talk about employee inclusion in employer software agreements.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and this is where I put on the work hat. And I talk about some of the things you might experience in the office. And this is an interesting area, which it's a hit or miss whether or not your company might be doing this. I've enjoyed the benefits of working for a number of different companies over the years, and some of them have added this on in various forms as kind of a perk, kind of a bonus for working for the company. But it gets into even greater areas because even though it winds up as a perk, it's also a perk for the company. What is this? All right. So, in the business world, you go into the office and you're utilizing Microsoft Office. Probably. Maybe you're using something else, but I'm going to use Microsoft Office as the demonstration for this particular moment. Now, you've got Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel, Microsoft PowerPoint, and yes, a few other items along the way. Now, wouldn't it be great if you could use that exact same software, the exact same version at home? And the reality is you can in some companies. And why is this? Because the company makes a deal with the software manufacturer, in this case, Microsoft. And they say, hey, we've got a number of employees. We're going to buy this many thousand licenses, and we want to grant that licensing for them to utilize at home so that they're more up to speed with the software, so that they're able to be more reliable at the office when they're working. And there are a number of different deals that are worked out. Okay, you'll pay another $20 per license, and it works out because, well, they can only utilize, you know, we've got Joe Worker right over here. Joe Worker can only utilize Microsoft Office at one computer at a time. He's at the office. He's, you know, 15 miles away from home. So he's not using the version of Office at home. He's just using the one at the office. When he goes home, he can use Microsoft Office there. Win-win, because now Joe is utilizing Microsoft Office more. Win for the company. Win for the software manufacturer, because when Joe goes to company two later on in his career, he's going to say, hey, I used to use Microsoft Office back at my old company. I'm using it here at the new company. Or maybe I'm not, but hey, I want to use it at home because I like it a lot more than this weird soft micro software that it's called Letters instead of Word. It's called Numbers instead of Excel. And no, that's not a dig necessarily at Apple, who does name their own software as such. It's just a matter of there are different names out there and different software packages. So he has that allegiance now to Microsoft Word and Excel and PowerPoint and Microsoft Office. So Microsoft benefits from this. So you can see there's a lot of benefit along the way. Why doesn't this happen at all companies? Well, some companies don't actually enjoy the idea of this because they might feel that they're going to be called upon to support some level of that installation at the home office. Some level of support of, hey, I ran into this problem with Microsoft Word. And that's actually kind of a no-brainer. I'll tell you, From my own personal perspective, if I've got somebody who needs just a little bit of help, a matter of, okay, he needs to understand Microsoft Word a little bit better, I'll answer his question. Why? Because it benefits the company. It benefits all of us when we all learn more about computers and technology. We don't have to be exclusivists, a matter of we're only going to support your Microsoft Office question and pertaining to issues that are here at the office. We're not going to make you prove out, hey, is this a spreadsheet you developed here or did you develop this at home? Because that knowledge comes into so many different places. So I like this approach. Why do companies not include it? Well, yeah, again, we get into that support issue. There's also a cost issue. There's a bargaining issue sometimes. Sometimes they go along and they go, you know what? We don't want to pay that extra $20 for a license. Or maybe they aren't aware that it's available out there. One of the license packages that I dealt with a number of years ago actually was built in to the software. This was something that they said, hey, that's okay. We will extend this on out. You can install this on three different machines, this one license, and that is part of our licensing. We've also seen this in the antivirus world. Trend Micro, I worked with them. I was the lead contact for a company that I worked for about 5 years. And if anybody had a problem with computer viruses and malware and stuff like that, they would reach out to me before they would reach out to the external virus company. But we supplied that antivirus software through the company, through the arrangement with them. We supplied that antivirus software not only to all of our desktops in the office, but all of the home desktops and laptops for all of the employees. See, if they get a virus on their home computer, it's easy for that virus to transfer over to a disk, a flash drive, through email or something like that, and then eventually find its way onto our own work network. And yes, hopefully we're prepared. Hopefully we can squash that virus, that malware, that intrusion quickly. But it's going to be better if we stop it at the employee's PC, at the point of origination. We stop it there. Cold. And you know what? It was well worth it for the software company to do that because they got more brand name recognition. Households around the company knew what this software was and they leveraged it. They loved it. So, you know, find out if you work for a company, a large company, or even a small company, find out if there are any kind of perks like this available to you. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The countdown is on to January the 14th, 2020, for the official retirement date of Windows 7. With support for Windows 7 ending in January, the push to upgrade to Windows 10 continues. According to the data published by analytics vendor NetApplications, Windows 10's share of all personal computers ending in November with 53.3%, that's more than half. Windows 10's portion of the user share of all Windows PCs is 62%. The percentage of Windows PCs, 62%, is larger than the percentage of all personal computers, which is 53.3%, because Windows does not run every desktop and notebook. In November, Windows powered 86.1% of the world's personal computers. Of the remainder, all but a quarter of 1% ran Mac OS, Linux, or Chrome OS, with Apple's operating system largest by far of those. Usually, Windows 10 and its most popular forerunner, Windows 7, are in equilibrium. As one falls, the other climbs. November was different. As Windows 7 stayed flat, and while 10 dropped, Windows 7 share closed the month at 26.9% of all PCs and 31.2% of those powered by Windows. Windows 7's change last month was the smallest since June and ended a four-month series of massive declines that totaled 8.5%. The sudden slowdown in transfer of share from Windows 7 to Windows 10 may have come out of the blue, but perhaps it shouldn't have been a surprise. When you dig into the data, it turns out that Windows XP decline stalled substantially in the third to the last month before its retirement. 5 years ago, Windows XP user share of February 2014 increased by 0.3 percentage point as it counted down to a mid-April end of support. Microsoft will retire Windows 7 on January the 17th, which is only a few weeks away. The Redmond, Washington firm will deliver the final security updates to customer on that date, although businesses can purchase post-retirement patches through the Extended Security Updates program. Windows 7 may be close to its expiration date, but that doesn't mean everyone will abide and scrub it from their machines. It will continue to power devices for months, years to come, even on machines that don't receive post-termination patches. The stubbornness of Windows 7 in November, whether it's a measurement, anomaly, or a reflection of actual slowdown, means that the forecast of future changes based on the latest 12-month averages has to be altered yet again. By that prediction, Windows 7 will be running 27.8% of all Windows PC at the end of January next year, 2 weeks after its official retirement. If that fraction, slightly more than 1/4, doesn't seem substantial, it comes out to 417,000. That's the estimated number of Windows 7 PCs represented by 27.8%. Anyway you cut it, a lot of systems will continue to rely on Windows 7 after Microsoft puts it, at least on paper, out to pasture. A single end-user device today has more processing power, generates more data, and requires access to more digital resources than existed in the entire world just a few decades ago. A year later, January 31st, 2021, Windows 7 should account for still a significant 14% of all Windows for approximately 210 million machines. Meanwhile, Windows 10 will be on a course to be around 86.4% of Windows devices. According to this statistic, it has indeed come to pass that it would be notable most Windows users didn't choose 10. In February 2007, as far back as records go for net applications data, Windows XP accounted for an amazing 90.6% of all Windows, a monopoly caused by 5.5 years of availability with a lack of a successor. Windows 10 will surpass Windows XP record in April of 2021, according to the net applications projections, which points to Windows 10 accounting for 90.7% of all Windows at the end of that month. That shouldn't be much of a surprise. Windows 10 will be nearly 6 years old by then, and more importantly, it has no designated successor to cut into that share. Under earlier development and servicing models, Windows 10 would have been superseded by Windows 11 by now, with 11 competing for a finite share and with Windows 12 halfway through engineering. Instead, Windows 10 is to be the last Windows ever, meaning that at some point in the not-too-distant future, that operating system should own close to 100% of Windows. Perhaps for an incident will eliminate confusion and missteps when, in the heat of a response, things get overlooked and mistakes are made. In the net applications data, Mac OS marked a record 11.6% in the desktop OS share. November was the third consecutive month during which Mac OS share was 11% or higher, a number never breached before September. Increases in Apple's operating system have been balanced by corresponding declines in Windows as a whole, with a November 86.1% for the business standard operating system. Mac OS trajectory may push it above 12% by February, according to projections, based on its 12-month average. Net Applications calculates operating system share by detecting the agent strings of the browsers people use to reach the websites of Net Applications clients. The firm tallies visitor sessions to measure browser activity. So there is some fault in the way it's measured, because there are many vertical applications where the operating system does not go onto the internet, such as medical devices, ATM machines, and the likes. So actually, the Windows operating system has a much higher share of the overall market. And Marty Winston, All Hands on Tech, the changing face of CES, the Consumer Electronics Show.
I'm just guessing, but I'll venture a guess that you've probably heard of CES, the big technology show that happens in early January. Well, I'm here to tell you, it ain't what it used to be. In fact, if it hadn't changed, it almost certainly would have had to shut down. I'll explain myself. Some of you may remember COMDEX, a huge computer industry trade show. It originally stood for Computer Dealers Expo, hot when computers were in their boom years and there were company struggles galore for dominance on the one hand, survival on the other. Then something happened to the computer industry that we've seen happen to other industries. It melted into the larger landscape of end-user technology. And it's not the first, not the last, by far not the only industry where this happened. Sometimes an industry that seems self-contained will, like the computer industry, melt into a larger landscape. That happened to the office products industry and to photography. They, too, are all now part of an end-user technology industry. It happens to fad businesses, too. Even CB Radio, if anybody remembers that, it once had its own trade shows. CES was originally known as the Consumer Electronics Show. But what exactly does the term consumer electronics mean to you? Is it stereos, treasure finders, calculators, watches, alarm clocks, TV sets? Well, that's pretty much where CES started. The first CES, it's more than half a century ago. It was 1967. And if you were there, you could see things like pocket radios and that year's newest TV sets, TVs that had gone past the vacuum tube era, past the transistor era, and were newly being built with integrated circuits. Those were very big draws back then. At least among the 110 exhibitors who participated. 110. You know what that's become? The January 2020 CES has grown to have a few more than those 110 exhibitors. This time, more than 4,500 companies bought in. And they'll be visited by an expected 170,000 attendees. When I go to CES, I manage to see every booth there, but almost nobody else in the press can do that. Let's do the math. The exhibit aisles are open to attendees and press for 8 hours on January 7th, 9 hours on January 8th, 9 hours on January 9th, and 7 hours on January 10th. That's a total of 33 hours to see 4,500 exhibitors. 4,500 exhibitors in 33 hours, that's 1,980 minutes, that's 118,800 seconds. If you wanted to see every exhibitor, even with no lunch breaks, no bathroom breaks, and zero travel time from each to the next, on average, you could afford to give each exhibitor a grand total of 26.4 seconds. We don't have to get into my tricks of the trade for making that work. No, it isn't a TARDIS, but this isn't about me. It's about how CES has evolved. What was originally known as the Consumer Electronics Show and is now known as CES has been smarter than the many trade shows for those other industries. They've redefined themselves. In many ways, it was a survival issue. Instead of melting into somebody else's larger landscape, they redefined their own landscape, their scope, their theme, all of that. They now rally behind the idea that, I'll quote what they say, every company is a tech company, end quote. And they now describe CES as, and I quote this time quite literally from CES Executive Vice President Karen Czapka, quote, the global stage for the latest innovation across all sectors, end quote. I grant you that's exaggeration, but as you'll hear in a moment, they have dramatically broadened the sectors they're addressing. Also, perhaps with a bit of a bow to Barnum, she touts CES as a place where, and again I quote, attendees can expect the unexpected, end quote. Even the organization behind CES is no longer CEA, which was the Consumer Electronics Association. It's now CTA, the Consumer Technology Association, again, reflecting a footprint that's larger than just consumer electronics. At its heart, it's a trade association. CTA is a trade association to which manufacturing companies and others belong. So let me rush past the part that interests you the least, the business and economic side of all this. A trade association lobbies for favorable legislation. I'll skip that part. For CES, the trade show, and for the perceived vitality of CTA, the organization, it is strategically important to look like everything is growing and vibrant. You have to be bigger than yourself. So they used an approach that's been around for a long time, expanding their conceptual borders. It reminds me of Columbus, Ohio, which used to be a healthy but not quite major city, until they arranged for the city limits to include the entire county, meaning that surrounding suburbs became part of the city, increased its population and its size and its stature. A lot of the exhibitors this year make things that no consumer can go to any store to buy. Things like integrated circuits, radar systems, LIDAR systems, big battery systems, fuel cells, engines, and many of the new technologies that are part of electric vehicles and autonomous driving. Those companies are there because the people behind those vehicles are there. BMW, Daimler, Ford, and others are exhibitors, and many others will have their own presence away from the show floor but nearby. Bell, the helicopter people, is an exhibitor. So is John Deere. These aren't things you can shop for at Amazon or Best Buy. There's some alphabet soup to go with this. CTA identifies it as B2B2C, meaning business selling to other businesses that make things for consumers, or in a more traditional term, OEMs, original equipment manufacturers. In the past, most of the focus at CES has been a specific kind of B2B business-to-business selling involving dealers and distributors, or in some cases, large corporate internal use buyers. There never has been B2C, business-to-consumer. A consumer cannot go shopping at the CES booths. But the leverage of press coverage of the big crowds and the show-off of product picks at the show, many are stunt products that will never actually get manufactured, but all of this creates a lot of pressure on those dealer channels to not be left out when the demand hits. If you think about it, buying into that kind of craziness may be one small reason that you can't go shopping at Radio Shack or Circuit City stores today. Big corporations do scout the show for things that may make sense for them to deploy. Well, some of them do, and sometimes it's just an excuse for a paid junket to Las Vegas. Big appliance brands have been at the show in the past, but we don't remember seeing Toto, the toilet maker. Haven't seen them there before. We'd raise a beef. But the beefless brand Impossible Foods is also there. So is Procter & Gamble. So is Johnson & Johnson. There's a growing presence for companies in AI, in ARVR, in 5G, in robotics, and in those personal items that in polite company I can only identify as marital aids. CES also has what it calls marketplace areas, where it clusters companies with products, theoretically tech products, within special interest categories. One of the new ones is travel and tourism. Digital health gets one of these marketplace clusters. Sports technology gets one. Smart cities gets one. And there's one named Resilience, whatever that turns out to mean. Eureka Park, that's a name they have for an area within CES that sounds intriguing, but that I've learned to ignore. If you're going, it's the booth numbers in the 50,000s. These are startups, largely companies that are seeking crowdfunding. I call that panhandling. They keep promising to have the world's first ever of whatever it is they're showing. By and large, these are companies that don't understand manufacturing or retailing or business operations or pricing. Very few things are really the world's first ever. They're just people who haven't done their homework and who want to believe that they're very much more clever and inventive than anyone who ever came before them. And they know it because mommy said so. In the real world, very few products from Eureka Park ever succeed. For that matter, relatively few ever get manufactured. I'm sure there are exceptions, but I'm not putting up with the junk flow hoping to find a loose dime somewhere within it. To quote a Three Stooges response to the word Eureka, quote, "You don't smell so good yourself," end quote. And let me address one more claim from CTA. They tell us that CES attendees participate in an average of 33 meetings at the show and claim that this represents a 3.4 billion-dollar savings in business travel. Of course, that presumes that they all would have attended all those meetings anyway and ignores the observable fact that trade show amnesia kicks in and very few people can remember very much of what was said or promised at any of those meetings. So, is there a lot of new stuff at CES? You bet. Some of it, especially outside Eureka Park, may be available to buy before the end of the year, but never all of it. A lot of the, well, shall we say, most amazing products are one-off prototypes. They're to seduce the news media and to impress you. In truth, most of what you see available in 2020 will only represent a small variation on what you can go and buy right now. There's a saying that goes around the press lounge when we ask each other about certain categories or companies or products. It's available at last in purple, meaning nothing meaningful has changed. Next time, this show happens Christmas night, when the kids have already eaten up all the spare batteries you bought for their new toys, and when listening to us is a fun accompaniment to picking up all the wrapping paper and leftover gift box scraps of the day. I'll talk about some of the changes of 2019. You may have noticed, some you may not, and how they shift the road ahead in a Christmas night retro perspective. My gift to you, with no scraps left behind.
Thank you, Marty.
Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public.
The Westchester PC Users Group has a meeting January the 2nd, 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is the Codebreakers. They'll meet at the Keller Williams New York Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, Friday, January the 3rd, 2020, at 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Long Island Macintosh User Group will meet Thursday, January the 9th, 2020 at 7 p.m., Old Westbury Campus, New York Tech, and they'll meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Thursday, January the 9th, 2020 at 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building. Check at the front desk for the room number. Brookdale Computer Users Group, they meet Thursday, January 23rd, 2020 at 6:45 p.m. in the large meeting room of the Middletown Library at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey.
We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.